Judges chapter 19 tonight. You ready to go back to the auditorium, Jake?
I am. Yeah.
Well, maybe one of these days. Judges chapter 19. And I want to read just the first two verses tonight, and then we'll kind of get ourselves oriented, and we'll just kind of work our way through the passage as we go. So Judges 19, 1 and 2 is where we will begin, and then we will ask the Lord's help, and then we will go on from there. Chapter 19, verse 1, it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite sojourning on the side of Mount Ephraim, who took to him a concubine out of Bethlehem, Judah. And his concubine played the whore against him, and went away from him unto her father's house to Bethlehem, Judah, and was there 4 whole months. And we're going to, like I said, we'll stop there, we'll ask the Lord's help, and we'll go on from there. Father, I pray that you would help us. These are your words. Father, to us, these are old, old stories, but these are your people, and we believe your word. We ask you to teach it to us and to help us to understand its truths, your position, your assessment, your will and things, and I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we come tonight to the last story in the book of Judges. And if you recall, I hope that you will, Judges tells us about the whole time frame. So it takes us through the 12 judges, and in doing so spans most of the history of the judges. And then it ends with two different stories. 17 and 18 are a story, 19 through 21 are a story. And we're helped very much through the storytelling itself and understanding that layout. In chapter 17, very early in chapter 17, we're introduced to the man Micah, and then we're told, and in those days there was no king in Israel. And then we have all of that story. And then chapter 19 begins a new story, and you notice that it introduces with, it came to pass in those days when there was no king. And then we're not told that again until we get to the very end of the book, and the last verse of the book is, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So those are kind of the frames, the structure around which the story is told. And we will come back to that in a couple of weeks when we conclude the book, because these are God's inspired perspectives on what is happening. Everything that we read, and our heads will spin at times and our eyes will roll at times, everything should be read in the light of this, that every man is doing what he thinks is the right thing to do, what is good and acceptable and suitable to him. Chapter 17 and 18 are the description of Israel making their own gods. It is the collapse of the religious class. The Levites, they make their own gods. And in chapters 19 through 21, and we're going to take 3 weeks to really tell one story, chapters 19 through 21 are the destruction of their own people. So this is, what does it look like when every man does that which is right in his own eyes? It takes on a twofold characteristic: the destruction of God's religion and the destruction of God's people. Both of which, by the way, are very colorful, if you will, accounts of what Jesus described as the core teaching of the law. What is the law? Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Where did the Israelites fail? They fail with reference to God, 17 and 18, and they fail with reference to their neighbors, 19 through 21. So it really is tied to the entirety of the Bible story. It's not just a collection of weirdo incidents by people who have lost their minds, although they have lost their minds. So chapter 19, 20, 21 then are this single story. The chapter divisions are very helpful to us. They follow the story naturally, because in the destruction of the people, we have the people's depravity, we have God's anger, and finally we end up with, of all things, God's mercy. And this story, 19 through 21, is the second longest narrative in the book of Judges. Only the story of Gideon gets more word. So I want to start, however, by just going back to verses 1 and 2 and kind of orienting us around the events. We've talked about this a lot. The book of Judges covers 400 years, approximately. It is easy for us to default to thinking that the events we're reading are at the end of the 400 years because they come at the end of the book. But we can document pretty accurately that they actually come fairly early in the period of Judges. For instance, in Judges, and I won't have you turn to tonight, in Judges 20, verses 27 and 28, the people involve Phinehas the priest. And Phinehas is active in the book of Numbers and active in the book of Joshua. So it's not possible that we're 400 years into history and we still got Phinehas floating around. He just didn't live that long. The second thing that I want to address is the subject matter of a concubine. What does it mean to be a concubine? I mean, we read that this is what happened, that there was a Levite sojourning on the side of Mount Ephraim who took to him a concubine out of Bethlehem, Judah. And the Hebrew here is actually a little more specific. We understand it intuitively. Well, most of us do. Understand it intuitively, that a man would choose a female concubine, but the Hebrew is very clear that it is a female concubine that the Levite man chose. We tend to think of concubines as prostitutes, but that is not entirely always accurate. And in fact, in this instance, as in other instances, she is supposed to be a loyal and committed to this man who is actually her husband. Certainly there is a physical sexual dimension to the relationship, but there is also a legality to the relationship. In other words, for instance, Solomon's the easiest case, right? Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. What's the difference? What's the difference? And some of those differences, folks, are really more legal than they are in any other category. In some cultures, a woman was a concubine if she was socially inferior to her wife, to her husband. In other words, right, when you read about Solomon, and I'm just going to keep going back to Solomon, he's the easy case, right? When you read about Solomon and his wives, what Solomon and his wife shared in common was this. They were of the nobility. Solomon, the king, married the daughters of kings. To that extent, they were wives. It is entirely possible that Solomon had fully legal marriages to these women who were concubines, but they were not part of the nobility. They were not peers in that sense of the word. And frequently, if a woman was not socially equal to her husband in that kind of status, she would be referred to as a concubine. In some cultures, a woman was a concubine if at the marriage, which was a completely legal marriage, she just didn't pay a dowry, right? And the dowry was what the bride's family brought to the marriage and gave to the husband. So, right, you're taking my daughter and I give to you all of this stuff that is hers, and it now becomes yours, and I have paid the dowry. A woman might be a concubine simply if there was no exchange of dowry in this. So I just want to, we want to clear this up here, that it is not necessarily an illicit relationship for this Levite to have taken this concubine, and she's not necessarily a prostitute. Certainly the text tells us that she played the whore, and we'll get to that in just a moment. What exactly did she do in verse number 2? And the reality is that there's some ambiguity as to exactly what it was that she did. And the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, actually is very specific in saying that he made her angry and she left. The Masoretic text, the basis of most English versions of the Old Testament, are very clear that she played the whore. But exactly what does that mean? And I would just point out to you folks that it could very easily be that playing the whore is described by the remainder of verse number 2. His concubine played the whore against him. How did she do that? By leaving from him unto her father's house. That it doesn't necessarily, now it could be, and it probably was, but it doesn't have to be that she was morally unfaithful to him or physically unfaithful to him. But she left him. I mean, that's where the text is really taking you, that she left him. And one of the more interesting things about chapter 19, folks, is that chapter 19, both the good parts and the bad parts, are kind of told from the position of hospitality. And again, I think that the sublime message is this: love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so hospitality plays a huge role in that. And for whatever it was that she did and whatever the conflict was, her husband went after her, which we will begin to read in verse number 3. So as you were reading the story, and we go, well, she played the whore. Okay, what exactly did she do? Well, whatever it was that she did, her husband pursued her and went to find her. Verse number 3, her husband arose, went after her to speak friendly unto her and to bring her again, having his servant with him and a couple of asses. And she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the damsel saw him, he rejoiced to meet him. So the context, certainly the language is, she played the whore. The context is, they may have had a fight. She may have felt like she was mistreated. She may have ran home to daddy. And she did play the whore in the sense of abandoning her husband, of forsaking her husband. I will point this out further, that had she been truly physically unfaithful, her husband would have been well within his rights to stone her. Now, we're in the period of judges, and everybody's doing what they think is right, so there are not a lot of people who are committed to the text of Scripture. In other words, we could ask the question whether this Levite is really scouring the verses to find out what the proper response from God is. But had he stoned her, he would have been well within his legal rights, and I mean law of Moses, legal rights, to have his wife executed for her unfaithfulness. So this is where the story is. This is where it starts. We have a Levite who has married a concubine. She has at some level and in some way been unfaithful to him, and she has gone back to her father's house, and her husband has gone after her, and he wants to recover her, and he comes to bring her home and to make whatever appeal to win her back, and this is where we take up. Beginning then in verse number 4 down through verse number 9, and again, the story is told in kind of this hospitality perspective. What we notice is that the girl's father is very, very hospitable and very glad to see his son-in-law. The end of verse number 3, he rejoiced to meet him. And his father-in-law, the damsel's father, retained him. And he abode with him 3 days, so they did eat and drink and lodge there. And it came to pass on the fourth day, when they arose early in the morning, that he rose up to depart. And the damsel's father said unto his son-in-law, comfort thine heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way. And they sat down and did eat and drink, both of them together. For the damsel's father had said unto the man, be content, I pray thee, and tarry all night, and let thine heart be merry. So, I mean, he's really going out of his way to be kind to his son-in-law. And again, folks, this is not fluff and filler, right? The story is being set up. This is the way community people are supposed to treat each other. This is the relationship that is supposed to exist between people of the same community. But finally, the man, the Levite, says, I just got to go. I got to go. So verse number 8, he arose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart, and the damsel's father said, comfort thine heart, I pray thee. And they tarried until afternoon, and they did eat both of them. And when the man rose up to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the damsel's father, said unto him, behold, now the day draweth toward evening. I pray you tarry all night. Behold, the day groweth to an end. Lodge here that thine heart may be merry, and tomorrow get you early on your way, that thou mayest go home. And here is the first, folks, and again, we have to remember that we're being told a story. Right? This is where the music would change if we were watching it on our televisions. There is the suggestion of sinister in the wings. It's growing dark. The day is getting away. Stay one more night. No. I got to go. And so the hospitality of the father-in-law gives way in verses 10 through 30 to the horror at Gibeah. The man does leave late in the day on the fifth day, and they begin to make their departure. Verse number 10. But the man would not tarry that night, but he rose up and departed and came over against Jebus, which is Jerusalem. And there was with him two asses saddled. His concubine also was with him. And then when they were there by Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said unto his master, come, I pray thee, let us turn into the city of the Jebusites and lodge in it. And his master said unto him, we will not turn aside hither into the city of a stranger that is not of the children of Israel. We will pass over to Gibeah. And he said unto his servant, come, and let us draw near to one of these places to lodge all night in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down upon them when they were by Gibeah, which belongeth to Benjamin. So they begin to make their journey. None of the distances are terribly far, but, you know, the travel is pretty slow. And they reach a Canaanite village, Jebus, which will become Jerusalem. And the servant says, why don't we just stay here? And again, folks, remember, because where the story is taking us is the way God's people treat each other. This is the whole storyline. How do God's people treat each other? Or how can they treat each other? And so he says, no, I don't want to stay in a Canaanite city. I want to stay in an Israelite city. And so the day is growing darker, and they continue on their journey, and they finally arrive in Gibeah. Gibeah is a city of the Benjamites. And when they get there, where did we leave off? When they get there, verse number 14, they passed and went on their way, and the sun went down upon them when they were by Gibeah, which belongeth to Benjamin. And they turned aside thither to go in and lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat down in a street of the city, for there was no man that took them into his house to lodging. Now, of course, that doesn't sound weird to us, because who in their right mind in 21st century America would invite a total stranger into your home? I mean, none of us would do that. Nobody in their right mind would do that. If you get on 680 and go north and get off at Maple Street, and we have done that a lot with this flip house, there is almost always somebody there with a sign at the top of the hill when you get off of 680 onto Maple Street. It has never crossed my mind to say to them, hey, we got a couple of spare bedrooms. If you need a place to stay, just come to our house. But it's the way the world operated in the Bible days. These are covenant people. You're supposed to welcome the stranger. God is very clear about what is expected in as far as civility and kindness and hospitality among his own people. So if we were Middle Eastern in our orientation, if we were Bible in our orientation, we would recognize that there is something very seriously wrong in Gibeah that nobody will take in a fellow traveler. Finally, verses 16 through 21, a man does take them in, but the text wants you to know that he is not a Benjamite. And behold, there came an old man from his work out of the field at even, which was also of Mount Ephraim, and he sojourned in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. He's not a Benjamite, he's just living in Benjamite territory. And when he had lifted up his eyes, he saw a wayfaring man in the street of the city, and the old man said, "Whither goest thou, and whence comest thou?" And he said unto him, "We are passing from Bethlehem, Judah, toward the side of Mount Ephraim. From thence am I. And I went to Bethlehem, Judah, but I am now going to the house of the Lord, and there is no man that receiveth me to house. Yet there is both straw and provender," feed is the idea, "for our asses, and there is bread and wine also for me and for thy handmaid, and for the young man which is with thy servants. There's no want of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be with thee. However, let all thy wants lie upon me. Only lodge not in the street." So he brought him into his house and gave provender unto the asses, and they washed their feet and did eat and drink. So once again, there's this hospitality motif. The father-in-law was very hospitable. And when they get to Gibeah, nobody takes them in. But finally, there's a stranger. He's an Israelite, but he's not a Benjamite, and he takes them in. And then, of course, things turn very ugly. And what we have, folks, in verses 21 through 26, is not simply a horrific account. It is designed, particularly in the Hebrew language, to take you right back to Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. The language is strikingly similar. The parallels cannot be accidental. So, right, we've been being set up with all of this hospitality, only to have the rug pulled out from under our feet by what awaits this Levite at the hands of his countrymen. Verse number 22, "Now as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, certain sons of Belial, beset the house round about, and beat at the door, and spake to the master of the house, the old man, saying, Bring forth the man that came into thine house, that we may know him," which of course you understand is a euphemism for sexual relationship, "that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out unto them, and said unto them, Nay, my brethren, nay, I pray you, do not so wickedly. Seeing that this man is come into mine house, do not this folly. Behold, here is my daughter, a maiden, and his concubine. Them I will bring out now, and humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you. But unto this man do not so vile a thing. But the men would not hearken to him. So the man took his concubine, and brought her forth unto them. And they knew her, and abused her all the night until the morning. And when the day began to spring, they let her go. Then came the woman in the dawning of the day and fell down at the door of the man's house where her lord was till it was light." So Sodom and Gomorrah has come to Gibeah. And again, as I've said, the account parallels the Genesis 19 account right down even to using specific language, verbs, parallel construction. The point is this. In a world in which you are to be hospitable to your fellow covenant people, the Israelites have become like the Sodomites. And the text is, right, I mean, I don't think anybody would ever accuse me of being a feminist, but this is a challenging text for any American to deal with. And I can't imagine how you ladies feel at the thought of being treated like a piece of meat, not only by these brutes, but by the men of the house. But their actions are brutal, and the text is very pointed, folks. There is no escaping the hideous ugliness of verse 25. "The man took his concubine, brought her forth unto them. They knew her and abused her all the night until the morning. And when the day began to spring, they let her go." And you see how you have the dark and light theme going in the telling of the story. They knew her. It was a sexual relationship. They abused her. They made a fool of her. They mocked her. Maybe they physically abused her in addition to the rape. And when they got done with her, they discarded her. They let her go doesn't quite, in English, doesn't quite carry the brutality that the text does. They discarded her. They were done with her. But unfortunately for this young woman, that is not the end of her horror, because her husband is heartless in his own right. Verse number 27, and her Lord rose up in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way. And behold, the woman, his concubine, and by the way, if you think the narrator is going to be very clear here, and we'll really see this in chapter 20, the narrator is not giving the Levite any kind of a pass in this. Right? He is reprehensible in his own right. If you read this and go, boy, he was heartless. Yes, he was. Not only was he heartless, chapter 20 tells you he was a coward to boot, or at least a liar. Probably a coward, certainly a liar. So there's plenty of depravity to go around everywhere. So verse number 28, I'm sorry, back to verse 27. Her Lord rose up in the morning, opened the doors of the house, went out to go his way, and behold, the woman, his concubine, was fallen down at the door of the house, and her hands were upon the threshold. And he said unto her, up, and let us be going. But none answered. Then the man took her up upon an ass, and the man rose up and gat him unto his place. And when he was come into his house, he took a knife and laid hold on his concubine and divided her together with her bones into 12 pieces and sent her into all the coasts of Israel. Now, we would presume, but the text is not specifically clear, that laying there with her hands on the threshold, she is already dead. But the reality is, folks, is that the text does not specifically say that. That she may simply have been passed out, and that she ultimately dies at the hand of her husband. We don't know that. But I'm just saying that the text doesn't read as clearly as we might want it to. We just don't know if she was dead or comatose. He puts her on the donkey, takes her home, finishes the journey, cuts her into 12 pieces, and sends those to the border of Israel. So that this message is, the brutality of this message is telegraphed to all of the other tribes. Now, what this functions as, and as we see in chapter 20, this is a declaration of war upon Benjamin. That is the intention, and that is where this goes. And so we have then this observation in verse number 30. And it was so that all that saw it said, there was no such deed done nor seen from the day that the children of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt unto this day. Consider of it, take advice, speak your mind. So we are all invited to enter into the discussion as to what in the world is going on and what in the world people are thinking. A divine invitation to have a conversation about this hideous event. Now, we're not at the end of the story, because we're just really getting to where the story is going in chapter 20 and 21. But there are some things that we should note, and we'll make a couple of notes before we go. Number one, folks, right? This is one of the effects of sin that we love, that human beings love. Sin is very dehumanizing. Have you noticed, folks, that nobody gets named? What's the Levite's name? Don't know. What's his wife's name? Don't know. What's father-in-law's name? Don't know. What about the stranger that took them in? Don't know. The only guy in the whole account that gets named is Phinehas. Three chapters, one name, Phinehas. We believe that the story is told from this position of anonymity for that reason. Look how dehumanizing sin is. Sin makes people treated like commodities, objects to be used, objects to be discarded, objects to make a statement. But it doesn't value humanity. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself is the standard. There is none of that going on in chapter 19. Secondly, folks, we know this, left to our own devices, right? Because the benchmark that keeps being set before us is there's no king, and we think the implication goes way beyond a human king. Because there's no king like Jesus, everybody is doing what seems right to them. Our default position is humanity, not morality. This is where human beings go. We are fallen creatures who are always falling. Jude will say, now unto him who is able to keep you from falling. And the only thing holding mankind from being as worse as he can, as bad as he can, is the grace of God. Which, let's be realistic, right? This is the great fear that many of us have about where our nation is right now, is that God has withdrawn that hand of grace, and the fall is going to accelerate. Thirdly, we should take note of the fact that the quest for human liberty never leads to the happiness that we promise. I mean, look, folks, if you talk to the average American and said, wouldn't it be great if we had a world where everybody could do whatever they wanted to do and what everybody thought was right, we would argue that's the way it ought to be. As if this is the golden pathway to prosperity and security and happiness, but it is not. Everybody is doing what they think is right, and the rest of us are scratching our heads going, what in the world are these people thinking? And the answer is, almost nobody in the three chapters is thinking sanely or rationally at all. As one of the Puritans once said, before God judges a man, he removes his reason. Fourthly, we should note that individual actions contribute to the conflict and the collapse of a culture. Now, this story begins with the brutal destruction of one woman. It ends with virtually the annihilation of one tribe. One thing leads to another. Actions and thoughts both have consequences. And part of the folly of believing that we can do whatever we want to do is also believing that whatever we want to do never impacts anybody else in a bad way. Simply not true. And again, folks, I conclude with where I began. Chapter 17 through 21 demonstrate in this story form the failure of the people to uphold the basic ideas of the law. They did not love God. They did not love each other. And their society paid a terrible price for it. Now, next week, Lord willing, we'll go into chapter 20 and see the battle. And we'll see the conclusion, but that's where we will stop tonight. If you want to take your prayer bulletin...